Hello, welcome everybody to a Dharma class, which I'm actually doing, which is quite rare. Usually I'm somewhere in the world, except for Perth on a Sunday, the 2nd and 4th. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, this 75th sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Marghandiya Sutta, is one of the favorite suttas. It's got some great quotes in here. First of all, it shows that in the time of the Buddha, even the Buddha had people who despised him, who didn't like him, and Marghandiya was one of them. And there was also some of the great quotes, and you may have heard me and many other monks and nuns quote these quotes, such as, the greatest of all gains is health. Nibbana is the greatest bliss, the highest happiness. The Eightfold Path is the best of paths that leads safely to the deathless. That's in the Dhammapada, but that's also a very, very powerful saying, that Nibbana is the highest happiness. And again, lastly, we have this wonderful simile, which when the monks heard I was going to teach this, that's what they remembered of this sutta, the simile of the man who was sold a dud piece of cloth. What happens when you become enlightened and you say, wow, I was sold this dud piece of cloth, you know, called all those happinesses and stuff you like in life, and see what happens. And like many of these stories, it has a happy ending. But happy endings in the suttas, it's not the boy and the girl get married and live happily ever after. That's not the ending which you see in the suttas. There's a much happier and more believable ending. So here we go. Thus have I heard, on one occasion a blessed one was living in the Kuru country, at a town of the Kurus named Kamasadama, on a spread of grass in a fire chamber of a Brahmin belonging to the Bharadwaja clan. And just I'll pause there, if I'm correct there, that Kamasadama was also the place where the Buddha gave the Satipatthana Sutta. And so this place, Kamasadama, was supposed to be probably up, way up the Ganges, far from the source, and probably the most north, you could say the north-western part of the Buddha's area, you know, just south of Delhi. So it's really sort of a long way from his usual area. And it seems to be because, people have suggested, because of the type of teachings given there, the people in that area must have been very, very smart. Then when it was, number two, it's even the Buddha, just staying on a spread of grass in a fire chamber. Even the Buddha would live very, very simply. Even though he was a Buddha, he didn't have any special requirements. Then, when it was the morning, the Blessed One, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Kamasadama for alms. When he had wandered for alms in Kamasadama and had returned for his alms round after his meal, he went to a certain grove for the day's abiding. Having entered the grove, he sat down on the root of the tree for the day's abiding. Okay, that's common practice. You see that all the time. The monks, including the Buddha, would stay just anywhere. The fire room was almost like a little temple. And he would stay there for a while at night time. In the morning, just go and get his alms food. And then go and eat the alms food. And then just go off into a nice forest to meditate all day. Nice simple life of a monk in those days. Then the wanderer, Marghandiya, while walking and wandering for exercise, went to the fire chamber of the Brahmin belonging to the Bharadwaja clan. There he saw a spread of grass prepared and asked the Brahmin, "For whom has this spread of grass been prepared in Master Bharadwaja's fire chambers? It seems like a recluse's bed." "Master Marghandiya, there is the recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from the Sakyan clan. Now a good report of Master Gotama has been spread to this effect." And now I'm going to say this in Pali. "Itipiso bhagava alahang samma sambuddho vija charana sampano sukato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhammasarati satta deva manusanang buddho bhagava." As many of you chant. So you see those chants we do, they are actually coming from the suttas. And of course, the English version, that blessed one is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of the worlds. What does that mean, knower of the worlds? Is he a cosmologist? Is he an astronomer? Yeah, how many worlds are there in Buddhism? Three. Three realms indeed. They call it Tiloka. And what are those three realms? Anyone know? That's very clever. But what do they mean? The three realms are Karma Loka, the Rupa Loka. Karma, it's not like Karma, K-A-M-M-A, it's K-L-O-N-G-A-M-A. It's almost like the sensual world, which includes hell realms, animal realms, ghost realms, human realms, and the Deva realms up to the Brahma realm. So it's almost like heaven and earth, and the lower realms. That's only one of the realms, according to Buddhism. And then the other two realms, the Rupa Loka, sometimes called the fine material realm, and number three, Arupa Loka, the immaterial realm. Who knows what they are? That's right, okay, you are very clever. You get top student. Front of the class, yes. And also from Singapore too. Because that's what happens in Australian schools, all the Singapore kids come top. Anyway, what was I saying? Yes, the Rupa Loka is the realms which are based on jhanas. So it's the realm of the just the sixth sense, the mind, in the Rupa Loka, and the immaterial attainments is the basis for the other realm. And so when the Buddha says he knows the three realms, he knows not just the heaven realms and the lower realms and the human realm, but even these jhana realms as well, which very few people would know about. So those are the three realms. So that's why it says, the knower of the three realms. Just checking something out here. Okay. And, knower of the three realms. In comparable leader, persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. What does that mean, teacher of gods and humans? This means that sometimes he went up to Deva realms and God realms and taught them as well. This bed has been prepared for that, Master Gotama. And now, here we go, Magandhya does not like the Buddha. Indeed, Master Bharadwaja, it is an ill sight we see when we see the bed of that destroyer of growth, Master Gotama. Be careful what you say, Magandhya. Be careful what you say. Many learned nobles, learned Brahmins, learned householders, and learned recluses have full confidence in Master Gotama and have been disciplined by him in the noble, true way, in a Dharma that is wholesome. Master Bharadwaja, even if we saw that Master Gotama face to face, we should tell him to his face that recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth. Why is that? Because that is recorded in our scriptures. It's interesting why he says that, recorded in our scriptures. If Master Magandhya has no objection, may I tell this to Master Gotama? Let Master Bharadwaja be at ease. Tell him what I have just said. However, the Buddha doesn't need to be said. He's got his own special way of knowing, even better than ASIO or CIA. Meanwhile, with the divine ear, which is purified and surpasses a human, the Blessed One heard this conversation between the Brahmin of the Bharadwaja clan and the wanderer Magandhya. Then, when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from meditation, went to the Brahmin's fire chamber, and sat down on the spread of grass made ready. Then the Brahmin of the Bharadwaja clan went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side, and the Blessed One asked him, in other words, before being told, Bharadwaja, did you have any conversation with the wanderer Magandhya about this spread of grass? When this was said, the Brahmin, awestruck and with his hair standing on end, Because obviously somebody had read his mind, or the Buddha was practicing psychic powers. He replied, "We wanted to tell Master Gotama about that very thing, but Master Gotama has anticipated us." But this discussion between the Blessed One and the Brahmin of the Bhardwaja clan was left unfinished. For then, the wanderer Margandhya, while walking and wandering for exercise, came to the Brahmin's fire chamber and went up to the Blessed One. He exchanged greetings with the Blessed One, and when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, notice he didn't tell the Buddha what he said he was going to tell to his face, he sat down at one side, and the Blessed One said to him, he talked Dhamma first of all. Now, the other day when I was talking about how to admonish someone, I always said I'd like to say some nice things first of all, before you actually admonish someone. And this is exactly what the Buddha's doing here, first of all, just teaching some Dhamma first of all. Well, sort of, anyway. Margandhya, the eye delights in forms, takes delight in forms, rejoices in forms. That has been tamed by the Tathagata, guarded, protected, and restrained. And he teaches the Dhamma for its restraint, the restraint of the eye. Was it with reference to this that you said the reckless Gotama is a destroyer of growth? It was with reference to this, Master Gotama, that I said the reckless Gotama is a destroyer of growth. Why is that? Because it is recorded in our scriptures. The ear delights in sounds, the nose delights in odors, the tongue delights in flavors, the body delights in tangibles, the mind delights in mind objects. It takes delight in mind objects, rejoices in mind objects, and that has been tamed by the Tathagata, guarded, protected, and restrained, and he teaches the Dhamma for its restraint. Was it with reference to this that you said the reckless Gotama is a destroyer of growth? It was reference to this, Master Gotama, that I said the reckless Gotama is a destroyer of growth. Why is that? Because that is recorded in our scriptures. What do you think, Margandhya? Here someone may have formerly enjoyed himself with forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire, provocative of lust. On later occasion, having understood as they actually are, the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape, in the case of forms, things seen by the eye, you might abandon craving for forms, remove fever for forms, abide without thirst, with the mind inwardly at peace. What would you say to him, Margandhya? Nothing, Master Gotama. What do you think, Margandhya? Here someone may have formerly enjoyed themselves with sounds cognizable by the ear, with odors cognizable by the nose, with flavors cognizable by the tongue, with tangibles cognizable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. On a later occasion, having understood as they actually are, the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape, in the case of tangibles, they might abandon craving for tangibles, remove fever for them, and abide without thirst, with the mind inwardly at peace. What would you say to them, Margandhya? Nothing, Master Gotama. Now here we've got the five senses. Notice the absence of the six here. That's always taken as a special case. And this is actually the Buddha's teaching here how that we can abandon that attachment and craving for those things by seeing these five things, their origin. Now where do these things come from? Where do likable sights, sounds, smells, taste, touch come from? I'm not talking about the external cause, but the internal cause. It's just the sensory apparatus working its job. And also, once you see the origin, the disappearance. In other words, when the causes of that beautiful sight, the causes of that beautiful sound, smell, taste, or touch disappears, so does the beauty disappear. Saying here that those delightful objects of the senses, they are impermanent, they're unstable because they're all conditioned and caused. When the causes disappear, then the result disappears. And if anyone gets attached to the beauty while it's there, then of course is suffering when it disappears. Even the beautiful fish and chips, after a while, it just melts in the mouth, and it melts far too quickly, and then it's gone. Where's it gone? Yeah, and you have to suffer. The beautiful sex, after a while, what next? So there's always an ending to the beauty, because you know its origin and disappearance. And you also know the gratification and the danger. Because each of these things, even as I was saying the other night, with anger, there's a gratification, there's a delight in anger. Even with guilt or fear, the sense of being alive with those states is a delicious taste, a piquancy. Otherwise, we would not get into these states and attach to them. There's something delightful in them. Which is why that people attach, you know, even to things like grief. There's a delight there. But we also see the danger in those things. You know, it's like heroin, there is a delight there, but there's also a danger. If we can't see the danger, then we'll get stuck and addicted to not just the pleasurable things, but even what most people know are the unpleasurable things, but there's a certain pleasure in there. And that's going to come up soon with the simile of the leper, I think. So, and lastly, the escape from those things. How to escape from the concern about sight, sound, smells, tastes and touches. If you know those five things, then you're almost free of them. You know that, yeah, this is where they come from. Now, when those causes disappear, they go. That's the fading away of these things. You know that why we get attached to them, because we know that particular delight, that little hook, which makes us crave. But also we know the danger, that that hook is sharp and leads to death. So we not only see the worm, but we also see the hook. And also we know just how to escape from that. How if you're a fish, you can find other food, rather than that food, which is the worm or the fly on the hook of the fisherman. Any comments so far? No, the escape is always the Eightfold Path. In other words, you have to get those jhanas, but you're going to get there's other things in the jhanas. Remember, the jhanas are the culmination of the Eightfold Path, number 8. But it's a escape. You can't just say just jhanas. You have to those other things which actually bring up the jhanas. See? Okay, the precepts is an important part of it. Yeah. And a bit of mindfulness energy, a bit of right view as well. That's true, what you're saying there, and what you meant to say, was that when you know something more, something better, as is going to come up in a few moments, then of course you're not interested in just the beautiful, lovely sights, sounds, smells, tastes and touches. You've got something more, which is more enjoyable, more attractive. There's nothing wrong with it, but you know, if you had something much better available, then why wouldn't you take that instead? Why would we always go for the lower happiness when there's a better happiness available? Especially when the lower happiness, as I say, tends to make you more feverish. There's a lot of agitation, a lack of peace in the search for and in the holding on to the happinesses of the five senses, because they are inherently unstable. And sometimes we have to grasp on them to make them last that bit longer. So there's always like a craving and agitation, a strain on the mind whenever we have the pleasures of the five senses. However, there is another pleasure, which is, I always call these the pleasures of letting go. The pleasures of not doing things. The pleasures of a really relaxed mind where you don't have to go out and catch and hold and maintain. Oh, yeah. No, I'm talking about that sort of that back balance is like the base state of happiness. When one doesn't sort of go searching for the other happinesses, you know, that one realizes the real happiness, you know, the stillness, the peace, the, you know, the powerful peace of the mind. Now that is when you don't go out looking for those five senses, five sense pleasures, when you don't have to work so hard to get them and maintain them. The critical point you're asking is the capacity to remember those beautiful states. Many people have, some people have, not so many, have beautiful mind states. This, the important part is not just the capacity to remember those, but the capacity to understand them, exactly what they are and why they're so wonderful. And why the only way you can get into those deep mental bliss states is by doing nothing, not searching for them. These are states of mental rest. Whereas these other blisses of the five senses, as it says in there, they're states of mental fever. In other words, there's an agitation there, there's a striving, there's a wanting to hold. So once one understands the letting go, and the bliss of that letting go, then those senses, they're not seen as being such pleasures, they're just things which just come and go, a bit distractions. And even the greatest pleasure of those five senses, you know, is seen as still suffering compared to the bliss of the mind. Which is like one of those sayings, it's in the Anguttara Nikaya, where the enlightened one says happiness, the world thinks of as suffering. What the world thinks of as happiness, the enlightened ones say suffering. So once one understands that the base state of the deep meditations, the rest, the peace, and the bliss, which is far more pleasurable, literally, than the highest of the pleasures of the senses, then you look at those pleasures of the senses and they're not so delightful anymore. Okay, you know, they go up and down, but they're not really delightful. So you think, oh, so what? Big deal. Part of right view, but that right view is not a view made of faith, which is a problem because you can't have faith in such stuff because it's counterintuitive because it goes beyond one's experience. So one does need those deep bliss states to be able to understand and appreciate this, which is why here, like Magandia, just sometimes can't understand what the Buddha's talking about and calls him a destroyer of growth because it is a destroyer of that worldly growth. Now the prosperity of the sensory world. Now when we talk about growth in a country, you know, the growth in the economy and the ability to have pleasures in that five sense world. So I'm sure that even Peter Costello would probably agree with Magandia. The Buddhist monks are destroyers of growth. You don't have kids for a start. And every economist knows increase of population means better economy. So we are destroyers of growth. not really. There's something much deeper than that. Because the impermanence has two parts to it. It's the impermanence of things, they do come and go. But it's actually the permanence of the screen which knows those things coming and going. To see that, the senses itself disappear. So it's the simile I've given before on retreats is like the simile of a TV set. On the TV set, you have five channels, the sight channel, the sound channel, the smell channel, the taste channel, and the touch channel. This is a metaphor. And sure, you can actually see those channels changing, now you get sort of a nice program, now not so nice program, they're impermanent. And you can just take the good with the bad. But it's when you see the television set disappearing. That's the impermanence which shocks one. Which sees that all their pleasures and pain, they're a bit of a delusion there. even the TV set, it's not just the programs come and go, it's what they're shown on. You know, the sense bases themselves, that comes and goes. It's not what's out there, it's what's in here, being impermanent. And that's actually what the Buddha's talking about here. So a deeper level of impermanence, TV set, vanishing. And they usually say it's not covered in the warranty. In other words, completely unexpected. Okay. Magandhya. Here we go. So he's talking about if you let go of these five senses and you're taming them all, you can live without thirst, with the mind inwardly at peace. What would you say to him, Magandhya? Nothing, Master Gotama. Magandhya, formerly, when I lived a home life, I enjoyed myself, provided and endowed with the five cores of sensual pleasure, with forms cognizable by the eye, sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, and tangibles cognizable by the body, that I wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. And here we have some of those history of the Buddha. Now, there wasn't actually a history of the Buddha actually written at that time. But every now and again, in this sutta and another sutta, little sayings from here and here, here and there, you actually do pick, you do build up a picture of the Buddha's early life. And this is one of those snippets from the Buddha's early life, which in other places all put together as the early history of the Buddha. He said, I had three palaces, one for the rainy season, one for the winter, and one for the summer. These are the three seasons in Asia. I lived in the rain's palace for the 4 months of the rainy season, enjoying myself with musicians who were all female, and I did not go down to the lower palace. Okay. On a later occasion, having understood, on a later occasion, having understood as they actually are, the origin, disappearance, and gratification of days from escape in the case of sensory pleasures, I abandoned craving for sensory pleasures. I removed fever for sensual pleasures, and I abide without thirst, with a mind inwardly at peace. I see other beings who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, being devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, burning with fever for sensual pleasures, indulging in sensual pleasures, and I do not envy them, nor do I delight therein. Remember, the sensory pleasures here is anything which is enjoyable, which is nice, which is light, you know, in the five sense world. And not just sex, it's just, you know, a sunset even, or seeing a beautiful flower, and, or hearing sort of Beethoven, or, you know, smelling sort of the flowers in the early morning, or even the scent of the rain, you know, after the end of the hot season, or even, you know, just, you know, feeling comfort in the body, wrapped up in your nice doona in the early morning when you wake up. That's nice. All of those sensory pleasures is what's talked about here. And why is it that he does not envy people enjoying sensory pleasures, nor does he delight in those sensory pleasures? Because there is, Magandhya, a delight apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, which surpasses even divine bliss. Since I take delight in that, I do not envy what is inferior, nor do I delight therein. So because he knows something more, he said that is the reason he does not envy the inferior, nor delight in it. And what is he saying here? A delight apart from sensual pleasures, or apart from unwholesome states. For those of you who know the ordinary explanation, the usual explanation of the first jhana, apart from sensory pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, the meditator abides in the first jhana, that is, almost word for word, the beginning of the first jhana state. So that's obviously what the Buddha is referring to here. And he says that is even surpasses divine bliss. Yes. That comes from the commentary, and that I really disagree with. Because that is almost word for word of the definition, standard definition thousands of times in the suttas of first jhana. Now that which is apart from sensory pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, the monk abides in the first jhana, which has pitaka vichara, piti and sukha, and they actually don't actually say ekakata, but that's the fifth factor of that first jhana. And obviously that is higher than the divine blisses. As I said, that these jhana realms, if you like, they are above even the heavenly realms in the cosmology of the Buddha, of Buddhism. Even the heavenly realms, they still live in what was called the Rupa Loka, the first of those worlds, the world of the five senses. Beyond that, when those five senses disappear completely, beyond that, when the mind is apart from those five senses, and you experience that when you experience the jhanas, then you understand what it means. This is a bliss, even greater than the devas. So the Buddha said, if I know that type of bliss, why would I want to enjoy these other types of blisses? It was a sense of knowing something far, far, far greater. When the television set of the five senses completely disappears. Here we go. Carry on. Suppose, Magandhya, a householder or a householder's son was rich, with great wealth and property, and being provided and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure, he might enjoy himself with forms cognizable by the eye, sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, and tangibles cognizable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative lust. Having conducted himself well in body, speech, and mind, on the dissolution of the body after death, he might reappear in a happy destination, in the heavenly world, in the retinue of the gods of the 33, that's one of the heavenly realms in Buddhism, and there surrounded by a group of nymphs in the Nandana grove. Nandana means like enjoying. There surrounded by a group of nymphs in the Nandana grove, he would enjoy himself provided and endowed with the five cords of divine sensual pleasure. Suppose you saw a householder or a householder's son enjoying himself provided and endowed with the five cords of human sensual pleasure. What do you think, Magandhya? Would that young god, surrounded by the group of nymphs in the Nandana grove, enjoying himself, provided endowed with the five cords of divine sensual pleasure, would he envy the householder or the householder's son for the five cords of human sensual pleasure? Or would he return to human sensual pleasures? So it's just using a metaphor here. Now, even if you go to the divine pleasures of the gods, and you look down upon how we act, now, would that god say, oh, I want to be a human being again, you know, so I can watch the footy, you know, so I can just go and to a nice restaurant and have a good meal, so I can actually listen to some recital at the Perth Concert Hall? So, no, of course not, because the divine pleasures. Otherwise, what's the point of heaven? No, Master Gotama. Why not? Because heavenly sensual pleasures are more excellent and sublime than human sensual pleasures. So too, Magandhya, formerly when I lived the home life, I enjoyed myself provided and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure, with forms cognizable by the eye, etc., tangibles cognizable by the body, the five senses that I wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. On a later occasion, having understood as they actually are the gratification, the danger, escape, in the case of sensual pleasures, he hasn't actually included in this one the origin and disappearance, I removed fever for sensual pleasures, and I abide without thirst, with a mind inwardly at peace. I see other beings who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, being devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, burning with fever for sensual pleasures, indulging in sensual pleasures, and I do not envy them, nor do I delight therein. Why is that? Because, my Gandhiya, there is a delight apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, which surpasses even divine bliss, called the jhanas. Since I delight in that, I do not envy what is inferior, nor do I delight therein. Any comments so far before we go into the leper simile? These nymphs. Well, there's the old story of... You're very interested in it now, are you? I wonder why. This is the old story of the Buddha's cousin. This is his name was Nandiya. And Nandiya was a Buddha's cousin, and he was not interested in Buddhism Dharma. He, you know, came from a good family, very rich. He was just having a good time, like a playboy. But eventually, in those days, you had to get married, you know, if you weren't a monk. So the parents arranged this marriage. He was quite happy, you know, getting married because a really beautiful girl. But because there's a marriage ceremony, and because, you know, the Buddha was, you know, a monk and a cousin, they invited the Buddha to the dana, the marriage dana, you know, before they actually did the ceremony. So the Buddha went along, and they gave the Buddha and the monks a nice meal. And then, after the meal was finished, and they washed the bowl, the Buddha gave his bowl to his cousin and said, "You can carry this back to the monastery for me." He said, "But I've got the ceremony to do." He said, "You've got to carry it back to the monastery." Because the Buddha was actually senior to him, you know, in the hierarchy, you know, of like the family, Nandi didn't have much choice. And the wonderful part of this saying, his wife, you know, she was a bit of a character, or his fiancée, the one he was going to marry, she spat on the ground and said, "Okay, you go with your cousin, but you better be back before the spit dries up, otherwise you're in trouble." So you may try that to your husband when he wants to go out to get a paper or something. "Be back before this dries up." And that's what she did. And of course, you know, the Buddha sort of took him back to the monastery. And as soon as he got to the monastery, the Buddha said, "Okay, you can stay here now. I'm going to ordain you as a monk." He said, "I don't want to be a monk." And he said, "No, we're going to stay here as a monk because, you know, I'm your senior." And so the Buddha actually almost forced him to be a monk. And so his wife was very upset. But of course, he wasn't very happy as a monk, because, you know, he wanted to get back to his wife. And so the Buddha actually used his psychic powers and took him to this Tower Tingsaril and saw all the nymphs up there, all these beautiful girls. And then afterwards he said, "Well, you know, cousin, now what do you reckon? You know, that lady who's waiting for you to marry you, all these nymphs, now who's the more beautiful?" He said, "Oh, there's no comparison. Those nymphs, they're really hot." He said, "Well, there you go. He said, look, if you actually practice as a monk, then you make much more good merit, and then after you die, you know, it's only a few years, then you can go and have as many of those as you want." And he looked at his, you know, his future wife, you know, just about on the ground. That must have added something to his decision. And he looked at those nymphs and said, "Okay, I'll take the nymphs." So people actually joked to him and said, "No, you're only becoming a monk to get the nymphs in heaven afterwards." And I must admit that that's not what the monks of Bodhidharma Monastery are monks for. They're not doing that for the nymphs. But then what happened? Because he thought he was practicing, you know, to get a nice rebirth and have the nymphs up in heaven. But, you know, because of his good practice, that he actually developed deep meditation, got jhanas, became enlightened. And so he realized, I may have become a monk for the wrong reason. But now I've seen what the Dharma is. You know, there's no way. I'm not interested in nymphs anything anymore. So it was like a trick which the Buddha used to get his brother into the monastery, becoming a monk, and actually eventually becoming enlightened. So he never got his nymphs in the end anyway. So that's a nymph story. And the opposite, you know, for the nuns, you know, what's actually the opposite of nymphs for the male nymphs? Nymphets or something? I don't know. No, nymphets. I think we better stop this conversation quickly. Anyway. So he doesn't like them. Anyway, paragraph 13. Now we've got the leper simile. "Suppose, Magandhya, there was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the opening of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. Then his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relations, would bring a physician to treat him. The physician would make medicine for him, and by means of that medicine the man would be cured of his leprosy and would become well and happy, independent, master of himself, able to go where he likes. Then he might see another leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the opening of his wounds with his nails, and cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. What do you think, Magandia? Would that man envy that leper for this burning charcoal pit, or his use of medicine? No, Master Gotama. Why is that? Because when there is sickness, medicine has to be made. When there is no sickness, medicine does not have to be made. In other words, that when the Buddha is actually saying almost like these sensory pleasures, I like a sickness. You know, it's like, you know, always having to scratch, you know, to get some more happiness, to relieve the pain when the sensory happiness disappears. Always like an itchy, a demanding happiness. Or as one person said a long time ago, all these sensory desires, they're always unfaithful to you. It's a really nice saying, because once you get that pleasure, then it's as if the person divorces you and throws you away. You want another pleasure afterwards. It never promises you a lasting happiness. And because of that, you have to keep having medicines. But when you're free of the itch, the leprosy, it's like you're free of the itch to have to find happiness in the five sense world. The demand for satisfaction, for comfort even, in the five sense realm has disappeared. So too, Magandia, formerly when I lived in the home life, you know, I was endowed with the five sense pleasures, but now I don't take delight in that, and I don't envy what is inferior, nor do I delight therein. Another leper simile. Suppose, Magandhi, there was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the opening of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. Then his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, would bring a physician to treat him. The physician would make a medicine for him, and by means of that medicine the man would be cured of his leprosy and would become well and happy, independent, master of himself, able to go where he likes. Then two strong men would seize him by both arms and drag him towards a burning charcoal pit. What do you think, Magandia? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, Master Gotama. Why is that? Because that fire is indeed painful to touch, hot and scorching. What do you think, Magandia? Is it only now that that fire is painful to touch, hot and scorching? Or previously too, was that fire painful to touch, hot and scorching? The point is here that apparently in those days the lepers would actually use the fire to cauterize, to get rid of whether it was the worms or the infections. Because of the leprosy, they couldn't feel the fire, but even though it was burning. Master Gotama, that fire is now painful to touch, hot and scorching, and previously too that fire was painful to touch, hot and scorching. For when that man was a leper, with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the openings of his wounds with his nails, his faculties were impaired. Thus, though the fire was actually painful to touch, he mistakenly perceived it as pleasant. That's a very important point there. It says, though the fire was actually painful to touch, he mistakenly perceived it as pleasant. So too, Magandia. In the past, sensual pleasures were painful to touch, hot and scorching. In the future, sensual pleasures will be painful to touch, hot and scorching. And now at present, sensual pleasures are painful to touch, hot and scorching. Which is why I said those nymphs up in the heavenly realms, they're hot girls. Well, I remember somebody told me they saw some pornography and they called it scorching. And we actually use these words. That's a scorcher, I think they said. We actually use those words. Why? But these beings who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, who are devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, who burn with fever for sensual pleasures, have faculties that are impaired. Thus, though sensual pleasures are actually painful to touch, they acquire a mistaken perception of them as pleasant. Comments. The Buddha's actually saying something there, very, very radical. All those pleasures, which we take to be pleasurable, the Buddha's actually saying that you acquire a mistaken perception of them as pleasant. Yes, well, yeah. So transplants, say endorphins go into your brain or whatever. I remember just some incidents from my youth when there was always like pubs you could go to in London on a Saturday night. There would always be a fight. And I couldn't figure out why people go to such a pub, because actually they liked fighting. And that was actually physically painful. You see people with broken noses, with cuts and bruises. Why did they do that? Because actually that was fun for them. Or, you know, joking with Venerable Ajahn Bhumali, who was from Norway. You know, what is the Viking sort of heaven was Valhalla. You know, Val's Hall. And in Valhalla, this is the Viking idea of happiness. You know, you wake up there and there's food and drink, a big feast, so you stuff yourself stupid, you get drunk and you have a fight and kill each other. And then you wake up and you start all over again. Drinking, boozing, fighting and killing. And that was the idea of, you know, heaven for the Viking warriors. So, to me, that's a mistaken perception of what's pleasant. And sometimes, you know, people actually watch the footy. I think the footy's on today sometime, the Eagles or the Dockers. And people go to the Dockers and they take that as pleasant. They always come home miserable. So something's going wrong there. Anyway, yes, God. Yeah, that's right, yes. So it's just the growth of the human being. But it's fascinating. The Buddha is actually saying something which is counterintuitive, which most people do not agree with. Now, that's why Gandhi said you're a destroyer of growth. But the Buddha is actually saying that these pleasures which drive most people are a mistaken perception of these things as pleasant. It's questioning, are they really pleasant or not? And I think I also told the anecdote from my life that when I was about 14, you snuck into a pub in London. Actually, it could have been 13, I don't know. You're supposed to be at least 18. But you know, kids always pushing the boundaries. I snuck into a pub to get my first glass of beer, you know, with a mate. And, you know, what people think of beer, you know, not just in Australia, you know, in England, Europe as well. And I couldn't believe how terrible it tasted. And that was the first glass I took. But give me 6 months and I liked it. And simply because you had to like it. So I hope my whole perception changed to fit with what other people agreed with. And actually the real feeling of it was just nasty. But you know, you can't say that. And then one or two times I think only once I had whiskey. And gee, that was terrible. I don't know why people spend a huge amount of money on that stuff. But you know, the first time if you taste it, if you give it to like a young man, never tasted it before, I think that 99% of people think that's disgusting. But after a while, you acquire the taste. In other words, you program and recondition yourself to like this stuff. Yeah? Yeah. Gradually. Yeah. Yeah, well, the Buddha is that's actually the same. Maybe a bit more refined than sort of washing footy or taking beer. But still comes up with the same, what the Buddha says here, a mistaken perception of them as pleasant. Now again, this is radical, it's challenging, it's supposed to challenge you. If it doesn't know any better than that, any more than that, then you'll see that's the best. In the same way, the reason you brought that up is because you can reasonably say that, you know, watching a sunset or sort of seeing like a beautiful landscape, say in the bush of Western Australia, that's far, far more delightful than the beer or, you know, watching a movie on TV. There's a higher pleasure. But is there something better than that? In the same way, the person who has, let's say, gone along the Bibbulmun track and enjoy that walk, would think, these people go and watch soccer all the time. They're crazy. What do they want to do that for? This is much more enjoyable. And the Buddha is actually saying there's even higher joys, you know, than that nature loving. Or higher joys than aesthetics, you know, of watching sort of opera. Or watching sort of a great ballet. There's still something better yet. And people, aficionados of ballet, you know, would never go down to some nightclub and just, you know, start listening to some techno music. Why? Because they know something better. And the Buddha is saying, there's something better yet than seeing the beautiful rose. Or even seeing the birth of your first child. There's something more moving, deeper, yet. Da da da. Let's see what it is. Yeah. Correct, yes. A little dust in your eyes, lots of dust in your eyes is the saying of the Buddha. But the reason why a little dust in your eyes or much dust in your eyes is again the experience of the world. But not just the world outside, the world inside. So those with little dust in their eyes have explored the inner world and have seen some other pleasures and delights which are much more meaningful than anything which is on the outside. Okay, here we go. Another leper simile. Suppose Magandhi, there was a leper, this is number 17. Paragraph 17. Suppose, Magandhi, there was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs of the openings of his off the openings of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. The more he scratches the scabs and cauterizes his body, the fouler, more evil smelling, and more infected the openings of his wounds would become. Yet he would find a certain measure of satisfaction and enjoyment in scratching the opening of his wounds. So, Magandhya, beings who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, who are devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, who burn with fever for sensual pleasures, still indulge in sensual pleasures. The more such beings indulge in sensual pleasures, the more their craving for sensual pleasures increases, and the more they are burned by their fever for sensual pleasures. Yet they find a certain measure of satisfaction and enjoyment in dependence on the five causes of sensual pleasure. And again, this is a powerful statement of the Buddha again, saying that, you know, the more you indulge, the more you get caught up in that, wanting to indulge more. So the idea of, okay, I'll just get this out of the way, I'll just indulge as much as I want until I'm fed up with it. The Buddha says, no, the more that you indulge in the five sense pleasures, the more the craving for such things increases, and the more you are burned by the fever for sensual pleasures. Superior, yes. And then maybe you say that some people travel to Broome to see the sunsets because they're better. And maybe you might hear that maybe in Hawaii they're even better still, so you travel to Hawaii. Yeah. Or you marry a nice girl. She's wonderful, but then the girl next door might be even better. And so you keep on that way. So, you know, is there an end to that sensory pleasures? The people who go to nice restaurants. They go to nice restaurants, but there's always another better restaurant. Or they go to, you know, France to get the Michelin 5-star restaurants. And once they go to a Michelin 5-star restaurant, you can't eat in a 4-star restaurant anymore. So what do you think, number 18, what do you think, Magandhya? Have you ever seen or heard of a king or a king's minister? These are like the rich guys, the powerful guys in the time of the Buddha. Have you ever seen or heard of a king or a king's minister? Sort of, or Bill Gates or a George Soros. Enjoying himself, provided and endowed with the five causes of sensual pleasure, who, without abandoning craving for sensual pleasures, without removing fear for sensual pleasures, was able to abide free from thirst with a mind inwardly at peace, or who is able or who will be able to so abide. No, Master Gautama. Good, my Gandhi, I too have never seen or heard of a king or a king's minister enjoying themselves, provided and endowed with the five courses of sensual pleasures, who, without abandoning craving for those sensual pleasures, without removing fever for those sensual pleasures, was able to abide free from thirst, with a mind inwardly at peace, who is able or who will be able to so abide. On the contrary, my Gandhi, those recluses or Brahmins who abided or abide or will abide free from thirst, with a mind inwardly at peace, all do so after having understood as they actually are the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in the case of sensual pleasures. And it is after abandoning craving for those sensual pleasures and removing fever for those sensual pleasures that they abided, or abide, or will abide, free from thirst, with a mind inwardly at peace. So this Buddha is actually again saying here very clearly, the only way to actually to have real inward peace and to have a mind free from thirst is actually to first of all understand those sensory pleasures, where they come from, how they disappear, how they are contingent on causes, and the delight in them, the danger in them, and of course, most importantly, the escape. Once you understand the escape, then you'll practice that escape until you're beyond them. And then, only then, the Buddha is saying, you have a mind inwardly at peace. Then at that point, the Blessed One uttered this exclamation. And this is verse 264 and 273 of the Dhammapada. The greatest of all gains is health. So that's the best, better than winning the lottery, better than coming into a huge inheritance. The best gain of all is your health. And if anyone here is sick, you know that you'll spend all the money you have to get health. Because without health, how can you have any enjoyment at all? The greatest of all gains is health. And Nibbana is the greatest happiness. The Eightfold Path is the best of all paths. Not Vipassana, not Jhanas, not anything else. The Eightfold Path, he says, the best of all paths. The whole thing. For it leads safely to the deathless. Now, of course, the Buddha has just given a very, very powerful teaching. Let's see what Magandhya says about this. When this was said, the Mondo Magandhya said to the Blessed One, "It is wonderful, Master Gotama. It is marvellous how well this has been expressed by Master Gotama. The greatest of all gains is health. Nibbana is the greatest bliss. We too have heard this said by earlier wanderers in the tradition of teachers, and it agrees, Master Gotama." So he's agreeing with Master Gotama. "But, Magandhya, when you heard that said by earlier wanderers in the tradition of the teachers, what is that health? What is that Nibbana?" When this was said, the wanderer Magandhya rubbed his beams with his hand and said, "This is the health, Master Gotama. This is that Nibbana. For I'm now healthy and happy, and nothing afflicts me." So he hasn't got a clue what it means. Like many people don't understand what Nibbana is, but Magandhya also didn't know. He thought that, just being okay is Nibbana. Or just being healthy now is the highest. Magandhya, suppose there was a man, this is the beautiful cloth simile, this is a favorite one. Magandhya, suppose there was a man born blind who could not see dark and light forms, who could not see blue, yellow, red or pink forms, who could not see what was even and uneven, who could not see the stars or the sun and moon. He might hear a man with good eyesight saying, "Good indeed, sirs, is a white cloth, beautiful, spotless and clean. Good indeed, sirs, is this white cloth, beautiful, spotless and clean." And so he would go in search of a white cloth. Then a man would cheat him with a dirty, soiled garment thus, "Good man, here is a white cloth for you. Beautiful, spotless, and clean." And he would accept it, and put it on, and being satisfied with it, he would utter words of satisfaction thus, "Oh, good indeed, sirs, is the white cloth, beautiful, spotless, and clean. What do you think, Magandia? When that man born blind accepted that dirty soiled garment, put it on, and being satisfied with it, uttered words of satisfaction thus, 'Good indeed, sirs, is the white cloth, beautiful, spotless, and clean.' Did he do so knowing and seeing, or out of faith in the man with good eyesight? Venerable sir, he would have done so unknowing and unseeing, just out of faith in the man with good eyesight. So too, Magandia, the wanderers of other sects are blind and visionless. They do not know health. They do not see Nibbana. Yet they utter this stanza thus, 'The greatest of all gains is health. Nibbana is the greatest bliss.'" This stanza was uttered by the earlier accomplished ones, fully enlightened ones, thus, "The greatest of all gains is health. Nibbana is the greatest bliss. The Eightfold Path is the best of paths, for it leads safely to the deathless." So the Buddha is actually acknowledging here that he wasn't just the only Buddha. There were previous Buddhas in existence in times before. But now it has gradually become current among ordinary people. And although this body, Magandia, is a disease, a tumour, a dart, a calamity, an affliction, anyone who's old and sick knows that. Referring to this body, you say, "This is that health, Master Gotama, this is that Nibbana. You do not have the noble vision, Magandia, by means of which you might know health and see Nibbana." And obviously that those similes worked on Magandia, because now he wants to see. So that's actually the wonderful simile there, that sometimes when a person is blind and you get sold a dirty cloth, you don't know whether it's clean or dirty. And so you put it on and say, "Oh, what a beautiful cloth it is." But later on, it comes in a moment, that you get some medicine and you can actually see. Say, "Wow, what did I take that dirty cloth for as being beautiful? What did I take those sensory pleasures as being delightful?" Let's see what happens next. "I have confidence in Master Gotama thus. Master Gotama is capable of teaching me the Dhamma in such a way that I can come to know health and to see Nibbana." Here we go. "Magandia, suppose there was a man born blind who could not see dark and light forms, nor the sun and moon. Then his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, would bring a physician to treat him. The physician would make a medicine for him. By means of that medicine, the man's vision would not arise or be purified. What do you think, Magandia? Would the doctor reap weariness and disappointment? Yes, Master Gotama. So too, Magandia, if I were to teach you the Dhamma thus, 'This is that health, this is that Nibbana,' you might not know health nor see Nibbana, and that would be wearisome and troublesome for me." So he's saying, look, if it doesn't work, you're going to be upset at me. But Magandia is really determined. "I have confidence in Master Gotama thus. Master Gotama is capable of teaching me the Dhamma in such a way that I can come to know health and to see Nibbana." Okay, Magandia, suppose there was a man born blind who could not see dark and light forms, nor the sun and moon. He might hear a man with good eyesight saying, "Good indeed, sirs, is the white cloth, beautiful, spotless, and clean. Here we go, in search of the white cloth." Then a man would cheat him with a dirty soiled rag, thus, "Good man, here is a white cloth for you, beautiful, spotless, and clean." And he would accept it and put it on. Then his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, would bring a physician to treat him. The physician would make a medicine, emetics and purgatives, ointments and counter-ointments and nasal treatment. That gives a bit of the idea of the pharmacy used in those days. And by means of that medicine, the man's vision would arise and be purified. Together with the arising of his vision, his desire and liking for that dirty old rag would be abandoned. Then he might burn with indignation and enmity towards that man, that scallywag, who sold him that cloth, and might think that he ought to be killed thus. Indeed, I have long been tricked, cheated, and defrauded by this man, with his dirty soiled garment. When he told me, 'Good man, here is a white cloth for you, beautiful, spotless, and clean.' So too, Magandia, if I were to teach you the Dhamma thus, 'This is that health, this is that Nibbana,' you might know health and see Nibbana. together with the arising of your vision, your desire and lust, for the five aggregates affected by clinging, might be abandoned. That's the body, the feelings, pleasure and pain associated with the senses, perceptions, will, and even consciousness itself. So, together with the arising of your vision, your desire and lust for those five aggregates affected by clinging might be abandoned. Then perhaps you might think, indeed, I have long been tricked, cheated and defrauded by this mind. For when clinging, I have just been clinging to material form. I've just been clinging to feeling. I've been clinging just to perception. I've just been clinging to formations. I've just been clinging to consciousness. Never been clinging to anything worthwhile. With my clinging as condition, being comes to be. With being as condition, birth, that's the rebirth. With rebirth as condition, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. He's actually seeing the cause of rebirth and why you keep on being reborn again and again and again. Because you're clinging to the five aggregates, not knowing what you're clinging to. Just being sold a dirty old rag. It's very powerful. Any comments? Yeah, health means the end of sickness, which is the end of rebirth. So no more sickness. Okay, here we go then, number 25. I have confidence in Master Gotama thus. Master Gotama is capable of teaching me the Dhamma in such a way that I might rise from the seat cured of my blindness. Then, Magandhya, associate here with true men, Sapurisa. That word doesn't mean sort of men or women, it means just noble ones, stream winners, once returners, non-returners, or arahats. Associate with enlightened ones, he's saying. When you associate with those enlightened men, you will hear the true Dhamma. When you hear the true Dhamma, you will practice in accordance with the true Dhamma. When you practice in accordance with the true Dhamma, you will know and see for yourself thus. These are the diseases, tumors, and darts. But here, these diseases, tumors, and darts cease without remainder. And with the cessation of my clinging comes the cessation of being, cessation of rebirth, the cessation of birth, aging and death, sorrow and lamentation, pain, grief, and despair cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. And that includes something which you see every now and again in the suttas, which is very, very important teaching. The Buddha said to Magandhya, if you really want to get rid of your blindness, then you have to associate with those people who have also got rid of their blindness, you know, the other enlightened ones. Because only then will you hear the really powerful Dhamma. And that's something which is probably where we get the Mahayana or Vajrayana idea of a transmission going on. Not something psychic or something which is intangible, which you can't really sort of touch. But it's actually being in the presence of people who already understood that Dhamma, not just on an intellectual level, but an experiential level. And the stream winners, once returners, non-returners, and arahats. Associating with them, then you listen to those teachings, you know, in a very profound way. And that's an important part. It's an essential part in the path to enlightenment. That's actually made very clear in a couple of suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya. Because without that association with the noble ones, there's no way of actually understanding the teachings properly. And understanding those teachings and hearing them, then the next thing has to be you practice accordingly. And because you practice accordingly, then you see for yourselves. So you just get the inspiration from the noble ones, you get a clarification of the teachings, but you have to practice it. You have to find it for yourself. And again, when this was said, the wonderful Magandhya said, Magnificent Master Gotama, Magnificent Master Gotama, Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. Now he actually shows his faith by saying, I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dharma, and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. I would receive the going forth under Master Gotama. I would receive the full admission. So he was a wanderer, which meant that, you know, he was like almost like a free thinker, a part of the large number of people in India at that time who would wander from place to place, from teacher to teacher, searching out sort of a wise philosophy to live their life by. Who also obviously followed some scriptures. We never actually find out what those scriptures were, which he mentioned in the beginning. But now he's obviously listened to the Buddha and was very impressed. So now he wants to go forth. And here again, I would receive the going forth under Master Gotama. That's a novice ordination. And also the full admission. That's the bhikkhu, the full ordination. And the Buddha actually says, as part of the Vinaya, the rules, that one who formerly belonged to another sect and desires a going forth and a full admission in this Dharma discipline lives on probation for 4 months. At the end of 4 months, if the monks are satisfied with you, they give him the going forth and the full admission to the monk state. But I recognize individual differences in this matter. This is actually common. Everyone seems to say this. Venerable sirs, sir, if those who formerly belong to another sect and desire the going forth and a full admission in this Dharma discipline live on probation for 4 months, and if at the end of 4 months the monks, being satisfied with them, give them the going forth and the full admission to the monk state, then I will live on probation for 4 years. At the end of 4 years, if the bhikkhus are satisfied with me, let them give me the going forth and the full admission to the bhikkhus state. Which means that he said, oh, I'm humble enough, if it takes 4 years, I'll take 4 years, I really want to become a monk. And usually, if they say that, they get ordained straight away. Then the wanderer Magandhi received the going forth under the Blessed One, and he received the full admission. And soon, not long after his full admission, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent and resolute. We always make a point of that. If you want to become an arahat, dwell alone, be withdrawn, be diligent, ardent and resolute. The Venerable Magandhya, by realizing for himself, not out of faith, but his own knowledge, with direct knowledge, here and now, entered upon and abided in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home into homelessness. He directly knew, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being. And the Venerable Magandhya became one of the arahats. That's what I meant by the happy ending. So from the start, where he just denounced the Buddha as a destroyer of growth, then the Buddha sort of talked him around, and again, he talked him around on sensory pleasures, saying the 5 senses is restraining those pleasures, so you don't get any thirst. Sure, you can actually say that's stopping growth. But he also was saying that, you know, this is the higher pleasure. And because he can enjoy the higher pleasure, he's no longer involved in those 5 sense pleasure worlds. Which is why we meditate. Let go of the body, let go of the seeing, the hearing, the smelling, the tasting, the touching, to let go of that world. And that way we can understand, you know, the origin and the disappearance of those 5 senses. We can also understand the delight in them. Why? Now, we will get, for why people do get pulled towards them. We also understand the danger and the way out. And also we know the happiness which is beyond that. So that it happens. You know, if you get into, say, a jhana, and you really understand it, you think, gee, I've been sold a dud with his 5 senses. You know, I've often said, actually, today, she's not here today, I was offered a plasma screen TV. First time he'd offered one of those. Somebody's moving house or leaving the house and says, Ajahn Brahm, do you want a TV? Said, no, I don't want one of those things. Throw it away. But do you want a plasma screen TV? I've got one going free. If you say yes, I would be very upset with you. Say, no, I'd rather have the jhana. Because what do you want one of those for? I mean, you're actually being sold a dud. As I say, many times, if you see a small TV or a big TV, once you're watching it, it doesn't matter what size it is. The mental impression is precisely the same. The only time a big 6-foot wide TV makes any sense is when it's not turned on. Only then can you see its size. When it's on, doesn't matter small or big, you're in the center of the screen there. The perception of it is the same. So this is actually why a lot of times you're being sold sort of dirty old rags by this very clever salesman. But you don't know until the eyesight is restored. And once the eyesight is restored, you think, gee, what did I buy into this for? So that's my Gandhi Sutta. But Gandhi eventually understood, had his sight restored, and would never buy a dirty old rag ever again. Any comments? How many of you have got dirty old rags you want to get rid of? Any comments? Wow, you're all very quiet. Okay, well there we go. We finish off for today then. So now we can actually do the Arahang Sammasambuddho, and then I'm sure a couple of you got some personal questions. Maybe come up afterwards. That's Magandhi Sutta number 75, a very deep and powerful sutta.
Arahang Sammasambuddho Bhagava Bhutang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka-saṅgho Saṅkhaṁ namāmi.